This is Jean McMillan interviewing Jo Loy at her home, 59 Bostwick Street, on September 29, 2011. What is your full name?
My full name is Jo Ann Wong Loy.
When and where were you born?
I was born in New Orleans, Louisiana, on October 18, 1940.
And what were your parents' names?
My father's name was Gung Ching Wong, and my mother's name was Gladys Chin Foin Wong.
And do you have siblings?
I have three other siblings. I have a half-brother, Edward, and then a sister, Nancy, and a brother, James.
Tell me about your education, please.
Well, let's see. I attended the Allen School in New Orleans from kindergarten through sixth grade. And then we moved up to Chicago, where I attended junior high school, seventh and eighth grade, at Dixon Elementary School. This was on the south side of Chicago. And then from there went to public high school, Hirsch High School. And then from Hirsch, I went to Oberlin College in Oberlin, Ohio, majored in physical education. Took some graduate study work at Stanford University, and also am a half-baked social worker. I completed 1 year at the Columbia University School of Social Work.
Why and how did you come to this area?
I came to this area when my husband, Kiao, was asked to teach at Hotchka School. And this was in, he was going to teach in the fall of 1966.
Would you give me a brief history of your open recital program for the youth in the area?
Well, let's see. This idea came from, I was a member of the board of Berkshire Hills Music and Dance Association starting in about 1971. And over the years, it just seemed to me that there were very little opportunity for children who were taking private lessons to basically perform. And we didn't want a competition, but we wanted it to be more friendly, but also a little bit, say, the next level up from having a piano party in your teacher's home. And so with the help of Dorothy Massey and the support of Al Sly, the Young Artist Recital was born in 19, we had our first one in 1980. Is that correct, Jean? Did I say 1980?
I think so.
Or 1981, sorry. It would be 1981 because we just celebrated our 30th. We started planning this in 1980. And we chose the last Sunday of February, and it sent out letters to a lot of the private teachers in the area, as well as all the music educators in the public schools and the private schools, mostly in the northwest corner. And it was wonderful. We had so many different children. The requirements, it had to be a child between the ages of kindergarten through 12th grade. We were going to leave the choice up to the teacher. He or she was to choose a student that best represented technique, musicality, and promise at his or her age. So you could have a 6-year-old or a 7-year-old, and you could have a 17-year-old and an 18-year-old. And the wonderful thing about it was that the little children could see and hear what it would be like if they continued their music studies when those juniors and seniors played. And for the juniors and seniors playing, they thought back to the time when they were struggling at their first performance and had memory slips and this kind of thing. But it, the audience was so forgiving. And afterwards, we had a very relaxed, everybody got a certificate, and then we had a relaxed reception, which gave parents and teachers and friends the opportunity to go up to various performers and just say, what a wonderful job, who do you study with, etc. And this was the birth of the Young Artist Recital.
Did the pupils themselves connect and mentor each other? Or was this not something that was feasible because of the distance and area?
No, they did not mentor each other.
Okay.
And if the private school students, obviously, that would be very difficult for them to mentor anyone that was younger. If they mentored anyone, it might have been another student at their school who perhaps would be chosen the next year.
Oh, I see.
So the other thing was that you could not perform 2 years in a row.
Oh!
You could do it every other year, but the whole idea was to give many different students an opportunity to perform. And then later, I think in the 90s, we added dance, which was fabulous because it allowed a visual, and it was wonderful. We had two ballet schools in the area, and they sent their young people, and we had the modern dance department from Hotchkiss and some of their students, and so it really expanded the recital to a more complete arts program. Yes.
Is there a board or a committee that directs this?
We have a very relaxed board that does this. Annette Zimmersheim Hunt is now, has been a key member since the very inception, as well as Al, as well as, all our cookies are either donated, and that is organized by Heather Shoffley with the help of Linda Estabrook. And it's just wonderful. But that's the kind of thing where we just say, Linda, we're having the recital on this date. And she says, got it. And then, of course, Judy Dansker came in a little bit later. And she's now responsible for sending out all the letters, making the contacts. I do the publicity. And now that we have allied ourselves with the ASLI Music Fund from the Salisbury Congregational Church, we'll be able to have a more professional poster made and signs put out on the street. It took us 30 years to get there, but Al has always been interested in supporting and promoting young artists, and this fit right into his mission statement, and so it was a perfect, perfect match, and we are thrilled.
Do you have future goals?
Do we have future goals? I think one of the things that we want to reinstitute is dance. Mm-hmm. We no longer have dance teachers in the area. There is one school in Amenia which we would very much like to, talk to and encourage them to send someone. And so Teresa Carroll has offered to be part of our committee, and her daughters were very involved in recital through dance, and so that will be one of her assignments, is to see what we can do to get more dance students. As it turns out, we have more students coming in now from Massachusetts.
Really?
And it seems we've lost a lot of private school music teachers and in Connecticut. The private school schedules, are so packed that this is not...
It's not feasible any longer.
Right, and they have so many things in their own school. They don't need this community. And then the public school teachers, they're getting their students ready for either regional chorus, or regional band, or the Northwest regionals. and this is one more thing at that time of the year, or they're involved in school plays. So it's, we're really finding, like all arts organizations, that you're coming against sports and other competing activities. Yeah. And so I think the goal really is to keep it going and to just see if we can get the word out more completely, you know, so that many students will have an opportunity to perform.
And what kind of feedback do you get from former participants in this?
Well, it's really interesting, and that was some of the comments about when we had our 30th anniversary this past February, and that's February of 2011. We asked students to basically write about, you know, we asked past participants to write about the role music played in their life or in their lives today. And if we were just a part of that, some remembered, oh yes, I remember playing my violin and I had my hockey pants on underneath because as soon as I finished playing, I had to go to an ice hockey game. And so I thought, boy, if that summed it all up as to how students today are so committed to so many different activities. We had one student just basically say, I don't actually remember playing in or singing in your recital, but I do remember the song. I remember the context of me being in that show at the high school and how it really defined my life and my time. And he's now teaching in an international school. Ooh. In, I think it's Poland. And he directed Greece at his school. And that's how the arts carry on and on and on. So we have to keep this alive.
Oh, absolutely.
Because funds are being cut for art and music and physical education. And, you know, these are the life skills.
These are the joys of life.
Absolutely. And you use them well until, you know.
Yeah.
Heather Shoffley, who's 89,
is
and
still
playing bells and singing. So this...
It is a life skill.
Yeah.
Now, I know that you were instrumental in a story hour at the other end of the scale. Would you tell us about that?
Well, I just think I was at the right place at the right time. We're leaving Hotchkiss at that point, and Dr. Arnold Whitridge was the chairman of the Scoville Library Board, and he approached me and said that the board was thinking of starting a story hour, and would I be the one to come in and read stories? And of course, I love reading stories. I think the theatrical part can get in, and you can have different voices for different characters, and it's so much fun to see children either get surprised or laugh or even a little scared. And so we started it at the library. It was very casual, very open. You know, I think it was most probably a drop-in on a Saturday morning at 10 o'clock.
What year was this?
I remember my daughter standing on her tiptoes, so this might have been maybe in 71 or 72. Like anything else, everything just kind of is back there.
Oh yeah.
And so from that, there was such a great response that we then decided that between all the mothers who were bringing their children to the story hour, I realized that a lot of them were elementary school teachers taking time off to raise their children, very, very skilled at reading stories. And so we changed the whole program to a Thursday morning, partly because the one and only nursery school in town, Little Scholar, did not meet on Thursday. At that point, there really was no daycare, or if there was, it was very, very small. And so we still had a lot of stay-at-home moms who would bring their children. And I think we started with four to five to six-year-olds, and they came at 10 o'clock. And so we I divided it up between readers and crafts. And you would have one set of mothers doing crafts and another set reading. And when the reading got to be, the groups got to be so large, we split them so that we had 3 and 4 year olds in one group and 5 and 6 year olds in another group. And then they all met together for crafts. And it was wonderful. You had all these elementary school teachers. They came up with their own projects. They got all their own materials. They set them all out while the reading was done in another room. And I mean, it was just a well-greased machine because you had so many invested, motivated mothers. And at the year end, Barbara Collins, we had a sort of a wrap-up show with all the mothers, and it was Mother Goose Rhymes. And we asked the mothers to take a role, whether you're one of three men in a tub, or you were the kitten who lost her mitten. And, you know, it was, I mean, it was so much fun for the mothers. And then Barbara wrote a song that we would all sing. And, of course, we had zero practice time. So she had it all written out on these huge white paper sheets that we taped, that she taped to the bookcases. And so these were words to a very familiar song, and we just marched around singing like we practiced for hours. And it was a blast.
Now, so this story hour was at the library.
It was at the library before the renovation, I think.
Yes, it would be, because the renovation didn't come until a little bit later.
Right.
And the librarian at that time would have been Sarah O'Connor Wardell.
No, it was Ruth. Was it Ruth Miner?
Polly Miner.
Polly Miner, who was...
Yeah, I remember.
She was up high behind her desk.
Yes.
So as a child, you know, who was so little, handing their books way up high, looking at this woman, it was a little daunting for some of them.
It was a little daunting for some of us adults, too. I remember.
So we encouraged children to, and which was great, they took books out, then they brought them back the next week and got more books, and it was a wonderful, relaxed, it was a relaxed way of introducing children to reading and to the library.
Which is wonderful.
And I think once the mothers then started going back to work, daycare became more prominent. Our numbers were reduced, plus we were running out of people who were willing to volunteer. And so as a result, that form of story hour basically stopped. And I think we had a good 3-year run.
Okay. Yeah. So about 74, 75, maybe it stopped.
Yeah.
Okay. What other community activities have you been involved in?
Oh, my.
Sure.
I was on the board of the library, and then I was on the Salisbury Democratic Town Committee. I was on the board of the Williams Support Services, and I am involved as a singer in Crescendo, the Baroque music group based in Lime Rock. I was the president, I'm the past president, and held that position for 3 years, and am still on the board.
Wonderful.
So it's interesting how my finger is so dipped into music and the arts.
And you did not mention that you are a substitute organist for the various churches.
And then I performed in Gilbert and Sullivan.
Yes.
That was one of my goals when I retired. I just said, before I retired, I want to sing and dance on the stage.
And had you not ever done that before?
Never done that.
And what kind of an experience was that?
Oh, it was a blast. It was fun.
Oh, good.
The first one I was in was the Mikado. And so I thought, you know, if I really mess it up, at least I look the part. And then when I had friends come to see the Mikado, Joe, we couldn't find you on the stage. And I thought the makeup and the wigs must have been really terrific. Because They had a hard time finding me.
Oh, my.
Oh, but it was I had a wonderful time.
Was that the only one that you were in, the Mikado?
No, I was in Mikado and twice, and then Pirates, and then Iolanthe.
I saw you in Iolanthe.
Right.
That's the one, and I was not familiar with that, but I was able to pick you up.
I know it, to have a Chinese fairy. One of my favorite, experiences with Iolanthe. We were out in front of Laban's trying to sell tickets, and Peggy Heck and I had our costumes on. And this little child comes out and looks up at me and says, "Are you a real fairy?" And I said, "Well, what do you think?" She says, "I think you are." And she said, "Well, how did you get here?" I said, "Well, how do you think I got here?" She said, "Oh, I think you flew." And I'm thinking, oh dear, what am I going to say next? And so she wanted me to fly for her. And thank goodness, it was a very windy day. And I said, "You know what? I would, but it's so windy today, I'm afraid that I might end up just banging into this tree or into the building, and that wouldn't be so good." She said, "Oh, okay."
Oh, my word.
And when we were at Music Mountain, a little girl came up to Peggy and asked her if she was the Tooth Fairy.
That's what I thought you were going to say.
Yeah.
Oh,
so it was just wonderful that you could be this character only because you're in a costume, and how much fun to just on a very imagination level, yeah, go with the story, so which I love to do, and I did a lot of that in my teaching.
And isn't it wonderful in this day and age of technology and facts that there are still children that are creative and have imagination?
Oh,
absolutely. We need that.
Absolutely. And to have adults continue, mm-hmm, to be in that world of pretend. You know, I can be as silly as,
oh, yeah,
as any of the rest of them.
Oh, yeah. When my door was closed, nobody knew what went on in my room.
I think in a way was such a positive about teaching is that you're got your own little fiefdom right in your teaching space. But I loved pretending with the little kids and being just as silly as they were. And, you know, they didn't look at it like the teacher being silly. They looked at it like someone who was in their world and could communicate with them. And for them, it was fun. And when I got my education at Oberlin, I think one of the big things that stuck with me is that don't leave out the word play in physical education. And what is play? What is the definition of play? What is the definition of recreation or recreation? And because Oberlin was such, you know, a liberal arts college, I think my approach to physical education was that you don't have to be the top star athlete. You just have to know how to analyze and then fix something, which is basically to teach basic skills, analyze movement, etc. And it was very different in that respect. I think because their feeling was that they're often athletes who say, "Oh, you'd be great as a physical educator." However, for them, their skill set was so high and it was so easy for them that it was difficult for them to really understand what was going on to someone who was struggling.
Yes, and sometimes they're very impatient. Why can't you do? It's easy.
Exactly.
And it's not.
And I figured I'd met so many adults in my life who said they hated physical education. There wasn't anything that they enjoyed doing. And I just thought, you know, I hope after the 9 years, because it was kindergarten through eighth grade, that you've had me, that I will have introduced you to something that you like and would love to continue. And so there was a mixture of team sports, but there was also a huge mixture of lifetime sports.
What school did you teach in?
I taught in Cornwall for 33 years, and I also taught at Lee Kellogg for 17 years. So,
were you able to write your own curriculum as a physical education instructor, or were you circumscribed by the state mandates?
The state mandates were only suggestions, and so I was on the curriculum writing team for physical education, and so it was, you know, I think we had broad categories that you had to cover, and so, and of course the broad categories were things that I hoped that everything I did would fall under, and so, yeah, it worked out well, but it's just the whole approach that you can have a rigorous program, but it should be play and not necessarily always competition.
Now, you were teaching before Title IX.
Right.
All right. And would you define Title IX and how your teaching changed, if it did?
Well, it was really interesting. Before Title IX, I had separate classes. In fact, when I first started at Cornwall, I would say have the girls twice 1 week and then once the next week. And then I would have the boys once 1 week and twice the next. And then when Title IX came in, the directive came from the superintendent and said, okay, Title IX has passed. Next week, you will have co-ed classes. And I said, whoa, wait a minute. I think we have to, I'm all for this. I was someone who always taught the same curriculum to the girls and to the boys. I mean, it was no different. But we were asked to do it immediately. Well, the one incident that just sticks in my mind is that we were having a co-ed eighth grade softball class. There was a girl on third base and a boy on first. And he made a throw to third base, which you know is very long. And yes, it was softball. And she had her gloves out and she was all ready to catch it. And at the last minute, she parted her hands and that ball hit her right smack in the face and broke her nose. And all I remember is her leaning over, her blonde hair hanging down, and the blood running from her face like a faucet. And I was so angry because the boys had not had an opportunity to adjust their play. And, I mean, these are 12, 13-year-olds. And they had to learn to, you know, monitor their play and their
restrain themselves a bit.
And you would have to do this with another boy who was not as skilled as you. Maybe you would throw it, but just not as hard. But, you know, they had no opportunity to do that. And it was, I was angry mm-hmm. because it was part of that, oh, well, you only teach PE, so what's the big deal? It's, you know, you just go out there and play with a whistle. And there's no skills, there's no, you know, set, there's, and all I realized it was called educating not only my students, but the parents and the adults in the community who are not aware of what physical education is. They only think about what it was for them and their experience. I'm reading this wonderful magazine called Teaching Tolerance.
Oh yes.
And they're talking about physical education program that is not competitive, that's inclusive, you know, that you can adapt things so that everybody feels a part of it. And I thought, you know what? That's what I did my yep. whole teaching career.
What goes around comes around. It may be a 20-year cycle.
And it was frowned upon in a way when I started teaching because I wasn't competitive enough. I wasn't preparing these students for, you know, after-school sports. I wasn't a pre-varsity team program. And I said, but that's not my role. My role is to teach everyone, not just the skilled athletes. And I think at the end, hopefully, well, when the recreation program took over that part, then it allowed me then
to expand your creativity and teaching everyone.
Well, I think they then understood why I was so obstinate and stubborn in keeping my own philosophy and not bending to becoming a pre-varsity team warm-up, because that was really belong. I mean, it's a matter of philosophy.
And they're different philosophies, and they're different structures.
Yeah.
I think I would have liked to have you as a PE instructor.
That's the highest compliment I could get, you know, because we did have fun. Another thing, I wanted to have my boys love dance, mm-hmm. and so we had an international day. That's all right.